So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming on this Thanksgiving weekend. This weekend where gratitude is what is being celebrated. So thank you for coming. Is there anybody who is here for the first time? So for those of you here for the first time, usually the format on Sunday is the meditation, sitting walking meditation, followed by the Dharma talk. And there are many, many other activities and classes that are offered through our Dharma Center and our Mindfulness Institute. So for those of you looking for further instruction in mindfulness, mindfulness meditation, mindful living, there are many different kinds of programs that offer that. But usually on a Sunday, at least mostly, is we are dealing with various kinds of traditional teachings that have come down to us in the Buddhist tradition, and seeing what they mean and how they can be applied to enrich our lives. And for since early October, we have been looking into these very well-known teachings dealing with what are called the mind trainings. And they are teachings that go back, come to us kind of via Tibet, but came to Tibet from India and really have their antecedents many, many, many centuries ago, at least in the 8th century, with a great Buddhist master and writer and poet by the name of Shantideva. And these are the teachings that relate to how does one combine in one's life these two aspects of a spiritual life. And one is the aspect of wisdom understanding, you know, to understand more deeply what is going on in this life. Why do people suffer? Why do people treat each other the way they do? And at the same time that we understand what's causing that, we understand that there is another way. And the wisdom and the insight of the Buddhist teaching reveals both causes and conditions that support one type of life and the causes and conditions that support another kind of life. As well as in these teachings, there are these wonderful teachings about compassion, which is really, in a certain sense, wisdom is something that is deeply cultivated in a meditative way and finds its expression, obviously, in how one lives one's life. But if one's to say, how does one live one's life, it is compassion. And compassion in Buddhism is not necessarily meaning just, oh, we feel the suffering of others. It really has to do with an active identification with others. An active identification and some sense of responsibility for the suffering of others. And most importantly, wanting to relieve the suffering. So in Buddhism, compassion is not just empathy, it is this active desire to relieve suffering, whether it is one's own suffering, whether it is the suffering of those around us, whether it is the suffering of the world. So these two aspects of the teaching, this deep understanding of the nature of life, the nature of the mind, the nature of reality, kind of how things really are, wisdom, understanding, sort of the big picture, you know, seeing the forest, not just the trees. Most of us are just caught up in the trees, in the day-to-day crises or activities of our life, and don't see the bigger picture of life in which our unfolding takes place. But then after getting that bigger view, then how does one relate to the trees? We need to take care of the trees because they are us. We are connected to them. They sustain us, the trees, the forest. So we have to be good caretakers. So we learn that by learning how to be caretakers of others. So we are working through these slogans. There are 50-something of them. We're really only in the beginning stages, but the early stages are most important. So I won't all the ones we've been teaching on these past Sundays are all on the website, as well as there was a retreat several months ago, or not several months ago, back in October, where also they were taught. The different ones were taught. So if you're interested in them, you can go to our website and you can listen at your leisure. So the two I wanted to look with us today are, and this is the section called The Extent of Proficiency in the Mind Training. And I'm reading from this book called The Great Path of Awakening, the classic guide to using the Mahayana Buddhist slogans to tame the mind and awaken the heart, by a great 19th century Tibetan teacher called Jamyang Kongtrul. And he went through these slogans, which again, as I say, are quite ancient, but over the centuries, many, many different teachers have commented on them. So now we're in this fifth point, the extent of proficiency in mind training. And I want to look at two of them today. The first is, says, all dharma has a single purpose. And the next one, well, I'm skipping one, but the one after that is always have the support of a joyful mind. Now, let me just read his short commentary on the slogan, that all dharma, and again, dharma has many meanings. In this sense, we might say dharma means all the teachings and practices of Buddhism, all spiritual so-called teachings and practices that are about how things really are. And so he says, since the purpose of all dharma is simply to tame ego clinging. Oh, that's interesting. As you practice dharma or work at mind training, ego clinging should decrease. If your efforts in dharma do not counteract ego clinging, your practice is meaningless. Since this is the one criterion that determines whether dharma practice is effective or not, it is said to be the yardstick by which a dharma person is measured. Now again, for those of you who have been studying these trainings and those of you who've been listening to the talks, we know that the wonderful thing about these teachings is they take, Buddhism, hundreds and hundreds, thousands and thousands of teachings and texts, not only going back to the Buddha, but for many, many, many masters in all different kinds of countries for 2,600 years, they're quite voluminous, the teachings and practices. But the wonderful thing about these trainings is they bring them all down into short, pithy statements that get right to the heart of the matter, right? So this one gets right to the heart of the matter. All dharma has a single purpose. It is to reduce, to tame ego clinging. And if your efforts at dharma do not counteract, your practice is meaningless. So one of the wonderful things about these texts is they're fairly uncompromising. They don't give us a lot of wiggle room. And you know, as we like wiggle room. We like enough space so we can kind of do it our way. That's kind of how we, that's the way how we do life. Knowing that, they say it just like that. I mean, it doesn't even say your practice is mediocre, which we could accept, couldn't we? It says your practice is meaningless. It has no meaning. So since this is the one criteria that determines whether dharma practice is effective or not, it is said to be the yardstick by which a dharma person is measured. So again, there may be people in this room who consider themselves a practitioner of Dharma. There could be people in this room who see themselves practice of other spiritual traditions. There could be people in this room who see themselves as practitioners of those quote-unquote spiritual practices without any one. But this refers to all of us. You know, why are we practicing what we're practicing? Meditation, mindfulness, any other practice, study. And how do we know whether our practice is effective or not? Right? I mean, these are important questions, aren't they? Or else we can be doing lots of things. But if we don't have any criteria for effectiveness, we really could be wasting our time, couldn't we? And when we know in many other areas of our life, effectiveness is important, right? When we use cleaning agents, we want them to be effective, don't we? Like that. In a certain way, our spiritual practice is a cleansing process. But what are we cleansing? Many of us think, well, we're cleaning up the stress in my mind. I'm cleaning up my anger, my anxiety, my fears, my jealousy, my envies. I'm cleaning up things from my childhood, things in my past. Right? So there are many, 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 many things that we're cleaning. But what they're getting to here is a little deeper, right? Why are things, why do we have these afflictions? Right? What is really dirtying the mind? And again, when we talk about dirtying the mind, it's obviously coming from a criteria of what a clean house looks like. Right? We have to know what a clean house looks like before we can begin to wonder how dirty it is, or remember how it was to say it's getting cleaner. So in Buddhism, there is a clear criteria about what a clean mind is, what an awakened mind is, what a purified mind is, what is an enlightened mind. It is not only the absence of dirt. It is not only the absence of emotional afflictions and emotions and mind state. It is actually the presence of all the positive qualities, aspects of mind such as openness and spaciousness and clarity, ease, as well as the emotions like love and compassion and patience and understanding. I mean, so these are the qualities of a purified mind in which to understand our mind when it is not so. But what is the source of all this? Affliction and agitation, stress. What is the source of all the violence and aggression and the anger, insensitivity in this world? And here he says, ego clinging. Ego clinging means that one has a sense of oneself and one is clinging to that self at the expense of others. One way to see it is ego clinging, we might say, is the self is always experiencing everything as a reference to itself. As we go through life, as we go through our day, all our encounters with people, with situation, with the news, with our past, with present, always that I, me, mine is present. Everything refers to me. What do I think about that? What do I feel about that? What do I want here? What's in it for me? How can I get these people to pay attention to me, to like me, to respect me, to think highly of me? Right? That's just for starters. So it is this self-absorption, this self-reference, which is the source of personal suffering, relationship suffering, family suffering, and the suffering of the world. It is not seeing beyond the narrowness of myself. It is not seeing the needs of others, the sufferings of others, our connection to others. And it's this endless self-absorption, which is actually, you know, we are so self-absorbed with meeting our own needs and our wants and, you know, healing ourselves and all that, that we don't realize that self-absorption, which we think if we can just get all our needs met, and if I can just get everybody to love me and like me and respect me, and if I could just get my life and every situation in it just the way I want, we think then that is the way to get happy. Isn't that what we think? And yet for 2,600 years, Buddhism at least has taught just the opposite. That it's that endless self-absorption, narcissistic self-centeredness, which is and always working, struggling, manipulating to get our needs met in the world at the expense of others. This is the very source of our suffering. This is the very source of our unhappiness. And that actually, counterintuitive to the self, that it is by coming out of this world of self-referencing and beginning to go through the world referencing the needs and the wants and the happiness of others, that one actually becomes what? A happier person. But it is the cultivation of the altruistic mind, the mind of love, the mind of understanding, the mind of interconnection, that really is the source of peace and well-being within oneself, within one's relationships, and within the world, the planet, etc. So again, you know, many people begin a meditative practice, a spiritual practice, and what are they so... I hear this all the time since, again, we spend so much energy on meditation in our tradition, right? We spend so much energy in meditation in our tradition because we understand the source of happiness and suffering is within our own mind. That all our thoughts and feelings and perceptions and memories, etc., are all occurring where? Within our mind. So meditation is that tool that teaches us how to attend to our minds and transform them. Can you see that? We need to stop attending endlessly to the external world and begin to attend to that which is the cause of our suffering and what's causing us to bring suffering to others, which is nothing other than our own mind, which is affecting how we speak and how we act. So therefore, meditation plays a central role in the Buddhist tradition. But what happens to us? We begin to meditate, and all we care about is what? How's my meditation going? Right? You know, like it's a sport. Really, people, you know, it's like they go to the gym, you know, they practice meditation, you know, how's it going? Right? As if somehow this is an Olympic event. And if somehow I could just get my concentration better, and my this better and that better, then I'll have mastered this. Right? That's our focus. Once again, it's all about me. How am I doing? Am I successful? I don't want to be a failure at this. Right? See, the self is again turning this meditative practice into another self-absorption. Another kind of assessment, evaluation of self. And how do we want ourselves to be? Successful. Right? So when we perceive we're not being successful at something, And many people find they can't kind of master meditation easily, can't master their minds easily. They often get what? Frustrated. Down. Move on to something else that I can feel more successful at. Right? All Dharma has a single purpose. So whatever kinds of meditations, practices we are doing, whatever kinds of other spiritual practices we are doing, whatever study and reading we are doing, what is the purpose of all that? See, do we see the higher purpose? Do we see the deeper meaning? You see, do we have something to take these practices? I'm practicing compassion. You know, a lot of people, what's your practice? Well, I practice mindfulness meditation, and then I do this practice, and then I practice loving kindness meditation, and then I practice compassion meditation, and then I do the dedication, and then I do this, and then I do this, and then I do this, and that's my practice. And when I hear that, I go, well, that's wonderful, but Buddhism is not about practices. It's not about, you know, it's about transformation. It's about healing and transformation, right? It's about opening the heart and the mind. And all these practices we do should facilitate and be helpful in that. They are not ends in themselves. Does that make sense? I mean, it's important that we see this because we get caught up, because the nature of the way we approach things is we are so pass-fail and we are so obsessed by technique. You know, give me a technique. But Buddhism is not just a practice of techniques. It's not a purpose of just giving us techniques. It's about transformation. And what are we transforming? Our ego, self-centered, narcissistic way of being in the world. Drive, you know, there's another earlier slogan you remember, drive all blames into one. You know, rather than blaming everybody else in the universe, or blame, or even blaming me. No. Drive all blames into one means egocentricity. That's the blame. Right? It's not personal. It's like an epidemic that has spread throughout the world almost since beginningless time. People misperceive. Rather than seeing their interconnection, interbeing, interdependence with all life, they see their separation. And when they live through their separation, they experience their aloneness and their loneliness. When they live in the world of ego and separation, everything they perceive relates to themselves. It is either something that they want or something that they don't want or something they are indifferent to. If they think, if they want it, if they think it'll be good for me, they go after it, right? If they go after it and they get it, they're what? Happy momentarily. If they don't get it, they're frustrated. They're angry. They're disappointed. They're sad. If they think about things happening to them that they don't want to happen to them, they get anxious. They get worried. They get scared. That's all the world of self. Endlessly manipulating and looking at life through its self-reference. Buddhism says, historically, Buddhist psychology is a psychology of non-self. It doesn't deny individuation, but it denies an individuation that is narcissistic. that is self-centered, that only cherishes itself. And again, we do that as individuals, we do that as families, we do that as countries, we do that as religions, we do that as parts of religions, we do that as political parties or whatever they are, right? We individuate, we separate, and that is expressed as me and you. I am over here, you are over there. I have my interest, you have your interest. And they're in conflict, right? Aren't they? They're in conflict unless you totally agree with me. Then there's harmony. And that egoism and that short-sightedness is not only what people bring into their most intimate relations, family relationships, but what the world brings to each other, right? Everybody thinks we'll have peace in the world when everybody's like me, right? Everybody agrees with me. Everybody shares the same political philosophy, religion as me, right? And we see where that's getting us, isn't it? All Dharma has a single purpose, and we can evaluate. Again, if you want to evaluate your practice, your spiritual practice, your religious practice, whatever you're doing, and you want a criteria, it's not, you know, how your meditation is going. Again, it's not that, it's not that meditation doesn't have a purpose and a meaning and is not beneficial. But your criteria should all, you know, you could have a lousy meditation practice, but becoming more and more a selfless person. I take that. Okay? You can have a great meditation practice and still be an SOB. Is that clear? Right? You know, egoistic, self-centered jerks can be good meditators. Can't they? Can even look like good spiritual people. I mean, you know, acting is a career. Isn't that true? You know, some people get paid for it, but most of us don't get paid for it, but we still do it. Again, if we want criteria for my meditative practice, my spiritual practice, my study, whatever I'm doing, my listening to Dharma talks, my endlessly perusing the internet, absorbing more teachings. It's not how many teachings I've absorbed. It's not how many retreats I've gone on. It's not how well I spout various kinds of spiritual teachings. It is simply, am I a more selfless person? Am I less I-focused in my relationships in my life? Am I beginning to care at least as much about the well-being and the suffering of others as my own? Right? Do I care about the happiness of others, even the people I live with? Do I care about them as much as I care about my own? Or perhaps even do I care about more about them? As the Dalai Lama pointed out, you know, we're one and the world is 6 billion. You know, do the math. Do the math. And again, counterintuitively and counter to the messages of self, which always says what? Take care of me first. My happiness first. My and my suffering first. And again, I'm not saying that's not important, but it's not the only thing. And lo and behold, again, I'm only saying that because it is magical. that when one comes out of one's self-absorption, self-concern, and notices the people around us, the world around us, the planet around us, and starts caring for them and it, one will be happier. One's mind will be more at ease, and one will feel a whole series of positive emotions that one does not feel if one is only self-concerned. Self-concern, self-absorption, narcissistic living, no matter what Donald Trump says, you know, Donald Trump may be all kinds of things, but is he a happy man? In the way we mean it. No. We see where that leads us. I mean, that's why I think Donald Trump is wonderful. He shows us. He shows us the downside of narcissism. Right? But he's dangerous, isn't he? Because there are many other people who see it the same way. But there it is. There is another way. The way of selflessness, the way of love, the way of caring for suffering people. Not simply deporting them. So I'll hope to leave a little time at the end to discuss these are deep matters. And then the one, always have the support of a joyful mind. Again, there he goes again, right? Always. Many of us would be what? We'd be satisfied with sometimes. Anyway. Yeah, it'd be nice to have a joyful mind now and then, wouldn't it? It's kind of wonderful. Always have the support of a joyful mind. And then the verse, or the commentary. He says, when there is never any fear or despair, no matter what adversity or suffering is encountered, when difficulty is taken as an aid to mind training, and you always have the help of a joyful mind, then you have acquired proficiency in mind training. When adverse conditions come, meditate joyfully. In addition, learn to take joyfully all the adversity others experience. So this is a very high bar. And again, for those of you who are new or have come irregularly, there have been many slogans earlier that we've discussed this very profound view. So for some who are new, this may sound a little kind of over the top. But it's really not. Again, in these slogans, we are offered preliminaries, we are offered teachings about the absolute nature, the we might call the unconditioned nature of reality, the dreamlike nature of phenomena, many deeper kinds of teachings. We've already received teachings about how to do the exchange of self and others. And now we're getting the more specific trainings. Always have the support of a joyful mind. So just for starters, I'm going to take a vote. All those in favor of always having the support of a joyful mind, and the other one will always have the support of a joyless mind. Okay? So if we just asked ourselves, which would we want? How many people are in favor of a joyful mind? Raise your hand. Anybody in favor of a joyless mind? All right. I only say that because you see, it's so obvious, isn't it? But how many of us ask ourselves that question? Right? Whether in the morning when we wake up or in the big times when we think about our life, do we actually frame the question of our life in that way? You see, those are big questions and they give big results. But we are what? Our questions about, what's on my to-do list today? Right? Do I go to Home Depot first or Target? Right? Who do I call first? How do I deal with this one or that one? Is that clear? Right? Who am I inviting for dinner? And where do I want to go do this? And what should I buy at Publix? See, that's what we're concerned about today, isn't it? And that's just for home life. That's not even work or in other areas of our life. How many of us ask the question, today? Do I want to have the support of a joyful mind or a joyless mind? Isn't that a wonderful question? Isn't that the most important question? Because everything else just fits into that. But see, we don't ask the big questions. We just, you know, are like robots who just run around like the rat chasing the cheese all day. Who never stop and say, is this really what I want to be doing with my life? Right? How do I want to be as I go about my day, whether I'm going to Home Depot or shopping at Publix or going to work or doing this or at home? Do I want to have the support of a joyful mind or a joyless mind? That's important because that points us in a direction. Many of us don't have directions. And without that direction, we're always going to our default. And unfortunately for many people, their default is around joylessness. And why do they have joylessness? Because what are they cultivating all day? What?
Joylessness.
Yeah, joylessness. Because they're in their mind, they're always focused on what? Things that they're worried about, things that are stressing them, this problem, this anxiety, this worry, this disappointment, this hurt, this resentment, this, right? And we wonder why we're not happy. We wonder why joy and well-being and inner peace is not just part of our, you know, a natural part of our mind. How could it be? There's no room, right? Because we are so focused on all the things in life that do not have the ability to create joy. Is that clear? You know, they have the ability to create momentary happiness, right? We're looking for something, we go to the store, we get it. How do we feel? Happy, right? We're cooking something, it comes out well. How do we feel? Happy. Right? We have a nice interchange with somebody, we feel happy. I mean, there are lots of moments in life and things in life that give us happiness, but we're not talking about that kind of happiness here. We're talking about always have the support of a joyful mind. We'll never have the support of a joyful mind if our joy is predicated on how things are going right now. Right? Because that kind of happiness is always based on what? Things are going my way. When things are going my way, I'm happy. When things aren't going my way, I'm not happy. And since in life, you know, unless you're Donald Trump, most things often, or many things in life, don't go our way, we are doomed to a life of up and down, back and forth, happy, unhappy. Is that clear? His slogan says, always have the support of a joyful mind. So, how do you have the support of a joyful mind? Even in adversity. Right? So this is how uncompromising. Even in adversity, even when things don't go our way, even when we meet with so-called adversive conditions, always have the support of a joyful mind. So on the one hand, we are no longer endlessly involved in the petty squabbles of self, the day-to-day petty squabbles of self, and its endless worries and self-concerns and hurts and resentments and, you know. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know, that's not our focus in life. We're bigger than that. Right? We're bigger than that. We're not petty people. Are we? Well, there's a good part of us that is. But remember, the whole purpose of spiritual practice, of Dharma practice, is to show us another way. A way out of that pettiness, that ego-centered pettiness. A broader, wider vision of life. Every day, we have the capacity to be joyful. But we have to set our intention to do that. If we think about all the things that go on in life that cause us to be resentful, angry, worried, fearful, sad, disappointed, hurt, you know, it's all because we are only thinking about situations from my point of view. Isn't that true? But if every situation, every encounter with people, I am attending to them, I am interested in them. And even when they do something I wouldn't want them to do, my response is one of understanding and compassion, right? Rather than one of, look what they've done to me. How could they do that to me? Rather than going, you know, why are they the way they are? What's going on with them? What are they suffering? And is there anything that I can do to ameliorate their suffering? That is a response that will bring up positive emotions. Right? Or when we're going through our own aversion. Right? Rather than the way the self, like right now, I'm coming down with a cold. Now, who did I get it from? I got it from my loving grandchildren, who are a source of great joy to me. And yet here they are. They've given me their virus or whatever it is. Right? Now, I could be poor me, but there's another way to do it, which is what? To universalize it. Oh. Am I the only person coming down with a cold? Oh, they've had colds. You know, have I been concerned about their suffering? Right? How many millions and millions and millions? And colds are nothing. How about real sickness, real disease? Right? Now we're in the hundreds of millions of billions. See, I open my heart and I open my vision to realize that I am just participating in something that is normative to human existence. Right? So there's no anger, there's no resentment, there's no fear, there's no disappointment, there's no hurt, there's no blame, there's no time for the arousal of negative mind states. Is that clear? Many people, they get sick and they get what? They get angry. I mean, you can believe that? They get angry. They get angry at their bodies, they get angry. You know, they get resentful. They don't see the universality of illness and that this is an opportunity to open our hearts. Oh, this is sickness. This is normal for human beings. Yeah. All those times when my body was healthy, was I appreciative? Did I wake up every day when my body was healthy and say, how wonderful it is. Today my body is healthy. It's feeling good. My eyes see. My ears hear. My nose smells. Right? No. It's only when the nose gets clogged up and the eyes get runny that all of a sudden, you know, we attend to it. We attend to those things that are joyless. We don't cultivate joy. And you don't have to kind of make things up. Right? This is not fantasy. You don't have to make things up to be grateful and appreciative for so many things in life, for eyes and ears and nose, for people, for food, for the earth, the sky. But we have to attend to it. We have to come out of our deficiency. You know, many people, they live life from a deficit mode. What's missing? What's wrong? Right? That's a mind state. It's a view of life. It's not real. Buddhism teaches us that we lack nothing to be happy. And that happiness Again, it's not like, yeah, it's good to have our needs met. It's good to have enough food and shelter and clothing. It's good to have friends. It's good to have a good job. It's good not to have financial insecurity. Yeah, those things are all good. And we should want them for everyone, not just ourselves. But they should not be the criteria for the state of our mind. Because it says here, even in adversity, one can maintain a joyful mind. Adversity pushes us. Adversity challenges us. It shows us where we're holding on, where we're clinging, where we're still at a place where we think things should not be this way. I should not be this way. This should not be happening to me. This should not be happening to them. This should not be happening to the world, right? It is the self in its delusion, wanting things to be different than they are. And unfortunately, things are not different than they are. Things are as they are. And if one looks at them with understanding, understanding cause and effect, one understands clearly how things are the way they are, why they are the way they are, and if one sees that those causes and conditions are creating suffering, then one wants, within oneself or for others or the world, wants to remediate that, wants to alleviate that. That's the only intelligent response, isn't it? If there's something that can be done about something, let's do it. Something to be done, let's do it. If there's nothing can be done, then let's accept it. That's just the way it is. There's no room in there for the joyless mind with its angers and resentments and its endless rumination and obsession. Always have the support of a joyful mind. All Dharma has a single purpose. So again, these are just 2 out of 50-something slogans. They are very, as I said, for those who are new to them, they cut right to the heart of things. They encapsulate many, many Buddhist teachings in one pithy statement, and they give us a high bar. No wiggle room. They make us uncomfortable. Spiritual practice should make us uncomfortable. If you think spiritual practices is all ponies and Barbie dolls and warm fuzzies, that's not spiritual practice. Spiritual practice should make us uncomfortable. It should push us, it should challenge us. So we wake up. So we have a few moments. Questions? Any questions or comments about questions? I mean, anybody, please. I've been doing all the talking, forgive me. But everybody has their life, their relationships. How would you practice this in your life? Do you see any challenges, anything not clear? And do you see how this relates to what we do here? To mindfulness and meditation, and can you see that all that is needed to make this transformation occur? Are there questions about how to practice this? All Dharma has one purpose, and always have the support of a joyful mind. Everybody clear how to do it? Anybody goes, ooh, in my life, not even a chance. It's important that we talk about this. Don't be shy or embarrassed. And then he'll start up again on something else. Yeah. Well, so let me just say, welcome to the club. Okay? Again, we read it. Oh, so the question. So the it was the question. I mean, I get it. He says, I kind of know what to do, but yet, when challenged with adversity, even though I kind of pull out my techniques, I still find that it's a struggle. And in the back of the mind, there's a part of me that does wants to hold on, and wants to continue to ruminate. Yeah. So again, this is, you know, one of the things I say to people is real spiritual practice, we have to be marathon runners. We can't be sprinters. We like to be sprinters. We'd like to get this over with quickly and become Buddhas and be happy for the rest of our life. Right? But that only happens in the imagination or in moments of grandiosity. You know, we read the things, we hear a talk, and we go, oh, I get it. See, Dharma's not that hard to get, is it? No. And it all makes sense. And even the practices. I mean, these aren't like, you know, fire walking or walking on water. I mean, this is just, they seem so simple, right? And yet you find, oh, it takes time. We are, you know, reconditioning the mind, so to speak. Right? And so what is your name?
John.
So John, again, what you are just dealing with is decades of very deep practice in creating suffering for yourself. Okay? I mean, that's the truth. I mean, most of us have are great practitioners of worldliness, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? And a worldly view. Which often creates great suffering for ourselves. And now you want to change that. And again, even though intellectually you get it quite quickly, it is kind of disturbing to find that the conditioned mind, right, takes time. Okay. So again, one of the things we study here is cause and effect. Right? Everything is cause and effect. Why is my mind the way it is? Because of all the things that I've experienced, all my thoughts, feelings, perceptions, at least since birth, have left an imprint in my mind. Right? That is the conditioning of our mind. And certain thought patterns, emotional patterns, reactive patterns, we have done over and over again. So they have a deep imprint in our mind. Right? So when experiences occur that bring those up, right? The default always is the imprints, right? And that's just the way it is. You know, people talk about their mind like it's something like this alien or foreign creature, you know, my mind. I like to shoot it or something, or get rid of it, or chop it off, or you know what I mean, or at least lock it up somewhere, right? Or turn it off, you know. Because we have this thing, like this mind's a thing, and like, how did it get to me? You know what I'm saying? Well, we have the mind that we've been cultivating. It's as simple as that. You know, nobody has somebody else's mind here. Now, again, it doesn't mean that we don't have other. You know, we haven't been influenced, right? We haven't been influenced by parents and growing up and situations, but all those situations and other people's voices have left imprints in my mind. My mind, it means everybody has that, okay? That's why we have the mind we do, right? It's not an alien's mind, it's my mind. And again, you know, both in a positive and negative way, our mind has been influenced, has been imprinted. Right? Now, up to now, we have been the servants, the slaves of our imprinting. Right? That is the unenlightened way of living. We have been imprinted, we have participated in that imprinted unknowingly, and we just continue. The stuff arises and we just continue to act out with it. All of a sudden we start waking up. Oh, and we actually know that's what's going on. Right? Oh, it's just imprinting. Right? Oh, that's what it is. Cause and effect is conditioned my mind. Oh, I need to go through a process of reconditioning. It's going to take time. How do I do it? Two ways. One way is when the stuff arises, we no longer go with it the way we used to. We no longer feed it the way we used to, right? Even if you say, you know, it's still there as you're doing these other things, it may not be as strong as it was when you didn't have other things to do. So it is getting weaker, right? And the important thing is to be very strong in weakening, you know, those arisings from the past. Right? They come on their own, don't they? You don't bring them up. They just come on their own. That's just the way it is, right? So each of us has these arisings from the past, right? These reactive emotions and way of speaking and acting, right? That still arise and will continue to arise, that we need to respond to differently and handle more skillfully, that we don't keep feeding them, that we actually begin to quiet them and soften them and neutralize them. So that's half the practice. The other half of the practice is the cultivation of the opposite. See, if we're just doing this, I mean, that's not a lot of fun, is it? Right? I mean, it's always to be struggling with our reactivity and our negative emotions, you know, yuck. So that's something we have to do, right? It's like, you know, I gotta at least clean the house. I gotta take care of it. But then the other whole fun thing about having a house is what? How do I want it to look? You know, what kind of things, how do I want to paint the walls, and what kind of art do I want to put on that, and what kind of furniture, and how, right? I mean, right? Just having a house that's not dirty doesn't make it's a livable house, does it? So the other side is, and the more important side is, what am I cultivating? What new ways of thinking, acting, behaving? Less selfish? More selfless, less self-centered, more open, less judgmental, more understanding, less frustrated, more patient, more loving, kinder, keep my mouth shut more, you know. What am I, right? You see, that's where the transformation comes, right? We have to deal with the past, because it is imprinted and it will continue to arise. So that the skillfulness in that, combined with the cultivating a whole new way of being in life, that's what a spiritual path is around, transformation will occur. Are you as obsessive and ruminating as you were 5 years ago? What?
No.
Yeah, there you go. Right? That's called progress, isn't it? But again, we, because of our distorted minds, we go, how come I still have this, right? I want to be free of it. Well, you can see that you're freer than you were. And if you continue and accelerate your spiritual path, it will transform more quickly. But it's still going to take time. Right? If you don't want it to take time, then what? You know, use drugs. But there's a downside there. This is spiritual transformation. This is for real. Okay? Thank you. So we'll stop here.